Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. A very warm welcome to the Asian Logistics and Maritime Conference, jointly organized by the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region Government and the Hong Kong Trade Development Council. The conference provides a platform for users and service providers to discuss the latest trends of logistics, supply chain management, and maritime and the impact on Asia. To begin with, we would like to invite Mr. Fred Lam, Executive Director of Hong Kong Trade Development Council, to deliver the welcome remarks of the conference. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lam, please.
Chief Executive, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. On behalf of the Hong Kong Trade Development Council, welcome to the third Asian Logistics and Maritime Conference. I'm pleased to note that there are more than 1,500 of you in attendance from 33 countries and regions. You will be hearing today from 37 logistics and maritime industry experts. This year, our conference will focus on Asian opportunity and e-commerce. The opening plenary session will spotlight the emerging dragons of ASEAN. It will also look at the implications of growing trade between China and ASEAN. Those implications are considerable, given that ASEAN-China trade last year hit some $400 billion and is expected to climb to about $1 trillion by the year 2020. This morning's second plenary examines the impact of a global phenomenon, the rise of e-tailing and the retail revolution being driven by mobile commerce. Mainland Chinese consumers are certainly embracing it. A recent McKinsey study noted that e-tailing sales in mainland China last year hit $190 billion, and that's only the beginning, given that China has the world's largest online population. It's clear that the Asian region offers great prospects for the future of retailing. No doubt, this will have a profound impact on the global logistics and maritime sectors. This afternoon, the conference will present four thematic forums. They will cover China's infrastructure development and what it means for the country's distribution networks, the maritime evolution over the next 5 years, air cargo, and the challenge of small order and just-in-time demands and food logistics. Also, for the first time, we have added an industry exhibition. More than 50 exhibitors from 12 countries and regions are taking part, showcasing their services. This conference, with its wealth of speakers and its program of central industry themes, underlines the value Hong Kong places on the logistics and maritime sectors. And I know this is a subject that is very close to the heart of our Chief Executive. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me now in extending a very warm welcome to the Chief Executive of the Hong Kong SASR Government, Mr. Si Wai Leong.
Thank you, Fred. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. A very warm welcome to you all to the third Asian Logistics and Maritime Conference. Congratulations to the Hong Kong Trade Development Council on organizing this event together with the Hong Kong SAR government. I'm delighted that we have so many professionals from around the world at this event to discuss the challenges and opportunities for the logistics and maritime sectors. Hong Kong has a long history of being China's entrepôt and therefore is logistics and maritime hub. For the best parts of the 19th and 20th century, we were the center of trade between China and Southeast Asia. Now, of course, we serve the whole world. Our long-standing status as a free port means we are able to do business with all economic partners around the globe within a very liberal policy context. We have a sophisticated financial system, robust rule of law, and our common law system is underpinned by an independent judiciary. Taken together, these qualities provide favorable conditions for expanding our professional maritime services, including shipping management, finance, marine insurance, legal services, and arbitration services. And because Hong Kong is an international business hub, we also connect the mainland of China and the rest of the world. 2 months ago, I led a large business delegation from Hong Kong to Chongqing. Some of the delegates from Hong Kong represented foreign chambers of commerce in Hong Kong. Chongqing is one of the largest cities in southwest China. Flight time from Hong Kong is about 2 hours. It is an excellent example that highlights cross-boundary opportunities for Hong Kong-based logistics and maritime companies. In the past, all goods heading for overseas markets from Chongqing had to be shipped via ports on the east coast of China, such as Tianjin, Guangzhou, and Shanghai. Today, freight from Chongqing takes a shorter route via the Chongqing-Xinjiang-Europe International Railway. This rail link between Chongqing and Germany started operation in 2011. Travel time is about 16 days, which is less than half the time it takes for ocean-going cargo. Cooperation in the logistics sector was actually raised by the Chongqing government. Hong Kong already has close business links with Chongqing. In the first half of this year, the value of our import and export trade was about $2 billion, which is a fourfold increase compared to the same period last year. Hong Kong's logistics industry is fully developed with a great deal of expertise and experience to offer, not only to Chongqing, but equally to other cities on the mainland of China. For the entire 35 years of China's economic reform, many overseas banks, trading houses, and professional firms have been using Hong Kong as the base of their China operations. Hong Kong has open borders and equally open minds. China is a huge market. We have been sharing with our overseas business partners the combined advantages of both one country and two systems. Now we are welcoming more logistics companies to Hong Kong. The growth of overseas logistics business will enhance our city's role as a shipper connector linking the mainland of China and the rest of the world. Today, over 600 international transport and transport-related companies have set up regional headquarters or regional offices in Hong Kong. Hong Kong ship owners own and manage 10% of the world's merchant fleet in terms of deadweight tonnage. In addition, 7.7% of the world fleet in gross tonnage terms fly the Hong Kong SAR flag, making the Hong Kong Shipping Register the number 4 register worldwide. Intra-Asia trade, which has been expanding on the back of strong domestic demand, is expected to grow further as the formation of the ASEAN Economic Community takes shape in the next few years. Here in Hong Kong, we are preparing to negotiate a free trade agreement, FTA, with a 10-member ASEAN bloc. The Hong Kong-ASEAN FTA will help to strengthen trade and logistics in our region and add to the competitiveness and efficiency of our supply chains. ASEAN represents important opportunities for investors to connect with some of the world's most dynamic emerging economies. Massive public sector infrastructure programs in countries such as Thailand and new markets such as Myanmar and Cambodia represent exciting opportunities for the logistics and maritime sectors. Close to home, we have the Hong Kong-Zhuhai-Macau Bridge, which is scheduled for opening in 2016. Spanning over 40 kilometers, it will be the world's longest bridge tunnel sea crossing. This mega bridge will expand Hong Kong's cargo hinterland deep into the Western Pearl River Delta, the fastest growing region in southern China, and bring it within a reachable 3-hour commuting radius of Hong Kong. Also by 2016, our container port basin and its approach channels will have been deepened to receive ultra-large container ships at all ties. We are also working to enhance efficiency at our container terminals and identify land for the development of third-party logistics service clusters. As neighboring ports become more efficient, Hong Kong's logistics and maritime sectors must move up the value chain, and we are gearing ourselves for this new challenge. A recent survey by the Hong Kong Trade Development Council identified Hong Kong's strength in high-value logistics. We look forward to responding to growing demand in this region for high-end consumer products, ranging from luxury goods to gourmet food. Rapidly expanding e-commerce and e-tailing in the Asia-Pacific region also presents huge market potential for logistics service providers that are able to respond to new consumption and supply chain trends. Hong Kong seaport and airport are equally amongst the busiest in the world. To cope with anticipated demand, the Hong Kong Airport Authority is planning for the third runway at the airport. This project will expand the airport's capacity to handle over 600,000 flight movements a year by 2030 and double the current amount of cargo and passenger traffic. Apart from upgrading physical infrastructure, we are also scaling up efforts to groom more talent and various expertise to help support the growth of our maritime service sector. The government has recently earmarked funding to set up a $100 million maritime and aviation training fund. The fund will sustain and expand existing training and scholarship schemes and support the implementation of new initiatives through the tripartite efforts of the government, industry, and education and training institutions. To raise awareness of the opportunities in the industry, we have organized a Logistics and Maritime Week in parallel with this conference. It includes a series of industry-related seminars and events and offers excellent networking opportunities. At the same time, we will soon be completing a consultancy study on enhancing Hong Kong's role as an international maritime center. The findings of the study will enable us to formulate a strategy and roadmap for expanding our maritime services cluster. To upgrade and expand Hong Kong's logistics services and to strengthen our city's role as a regional distribution center and port hub, we will continue to enhance our transport infrastructure. Our focus is to ensure that Hong Kong retains its competitive edge in multimodal connectivity in air, land, and sea. In terms of soft infrastructure, we enjoy preferential access to the vast mainland Chinese market under our unique cross-boundary free trade pact called the Mainland and Hong Kong Closer Economic Partnership Arrangement, or CEPA. CEPA. CEPA gives a first mover advantage to Hong Kong logistics service providers to enter the mainland market. CEPA is a nationality neutral, which means that foreign companies incorporated in Hong Kong can enjoy the full benefits of CEPA. As the mainland of China continues to develop as a major shipping power, Hong Kong's mature maritime cluster will have new opportunities to develop closer cooperation with the mainland shipping industry. Ladies and gentlemen, today's conference aims to facilitate the sharing of new ideas and perspectives for the logistics and maritime sector. With the presence of so many renowned industry professionals, we look forward to hearing your views on how best to develop supply chains to meet the needs and maximize the potential of our region. I wish you all a very successful Asian Logistics and Maritime Conference, and our visitors a wonderful stay with us here in Hong Kong. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leung. Thank you. We would like to again thank our Chief Executive and Mr. Fred Lam for the welcome remarks. The two gentlemen shall now depart due to other business engagements, but we would like to thank them again for their presence. Thank you for being here with us. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we would now like to invite on stage our keynote speaker, Dr. Patrick Low, Vice President of Research, Fung Global Institute, who is also the former chief economist from World Trade Organization, to deliver the keynote address. Dr. Low, please.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me immense pleasure to be here today and to have the opportunity to speak to this august gathering, this signature event for the logistics and maritime industry. In the few minutes that I have, my remarks will start with some observations on recent trends in trade. And then I'd like to try to provoke some thinking about why we need to look at trade differently from the way we typically do, and what makes this important. So first, something about trade prospects and growth. The truth is that, of course, trade is the bread and butter of the logistics and maritime industry, but we really have mixed news about how trade is faring. It's certainly better from an Asian perspective, but trade performance overall has not been as good in the last few years as it was prior to the Great Recession of some 5 years ago. The volume of world trade in the last 20 years averaged 5.5% growth per year, considerably more than production growth. But for the last 7 years, that number has been 3.5%. Last year, it was 2.3%. This year, the WTO is estimating 2.5%. These are not great numbers. However, we are much more optimistic for 2014, and we're predicting a growth rate of 4.5%. The news from Asia, as I mentioned, is somewhat better. Asia has consistently performed above average. In fact, in many ways, one can say that intra-Asian trade has been the driving force of global trade. It's grown faster in nominal terms than 10% per year. A remarkable story is trade between ASEAN and China. Trade flows in both directions, again in nominal terms, have averaged 20% per year for the last 20 years. That's big. For ASEAN, this is twice the growth rate of trade with their trade with the rest of Asia. For China, the figure is 15% as compared to the 20% with ASEAN. So the trade relationship between ASEAN and China stands out for its dynamism. I found it surprising that a big part of this trade story is capital goods in both directions. The share of capital goods going to ASEAN from China rose from 15% to 14% in the 20 years up to 2012. The relevant figures for ASEAN exports to China are 21% and 42% over that same period. In sum, a relatively sluggish picture for global trade in the last few years is compensated in part by the dynamic story from Asia. Moreover, the outlook for 2014 is more promising, with trade growth moving closer to pre-crisis growth rates. But we're not there yet. Without recovery in GDP growth, we won't do better in trade growth. Now, why do we look at trade? Why should we look at trade differently from the way we'd have traditionally done so? I think this will be quite familiar to many of you, but I think it really needs to be stressed. Typically, we have tended to measure trade as gross flows. What we should be doing is measuring it in the same way as we measure national income, GDP, focusing not on the value of final products, but on who adds value in production and where that value is added. Let me cite an example from a Fung Global Institute study of a high-end gentleman's jacket. This jacket appears in the shops in the United States as a product from China, retailing at $425. In fact, Asian manufacturing costs, including those originating in China, for this $425 jacket, amount to only $9. And yet, it says on the label of the jacket, made in China. The rest comprises intangibles or services. Some of that value may indeed come from Asian logistics services. The rest is upstream inputs, such as design, branding, intellectual property, and downstream values such as advertising, marketing, retailing. Profits are also in there somewhere. This intangible value can come from any number of different geographical sources, although in this case, in all likelihood, much of it probably is of US provenance. That $425 price tag is, of course, likely to come down a little, because in the clothing industry, where fashions change fast, inventory is the enemy of profit. Nevertheless, calling this a product from China is really a stretch. When we look at trade in this way, through the lens of who has value and where we get a very different picture of the world. Another well-known example, which I shall quickly cite, is the Apple iPhone. This appears in US trade statistics as a high-tech import from China when recorded in terms of gross trade flows. But actually, China's input is basically assembly, valued at less than 5% of the retail price of that iPhone. The rest comes as intangibles and components from such places as Japan, Korea, Germany, and the US itself. Let me highlight some of the advantages of acquiring a better understanding of the true sources of value in global trade. First of all, it gives us a better appreciation of the true nature of interdependency among nations through trade. Anything from 50 to 75% of all goods imported are intermediates destined to be inputs into domestic production on supply chains that serve export markets. In other words, a large chunk of many a country's imports are also its exports. Second, we can understand much better the true technology content of bilateral trade flows if we look at it in terms of value addition. Thirdly, bilateral trade flows can look quite different when we measure what value is actually added where. When China's bilateral trade surplus with the United States was the source of such contention, and perhaps it still is, the true figure was somewhere around one-third less than what we read in the newspapers. Fourth, the value-added measure gets rid of double or multiple counting in trade that arises when some components cross international frontiers more than once. This is good business for suppliers of logistics services and maritime services, of course, but it inflates the overall trade numbers. Finally, when we measure trade in value-added terms, we get a much more accurate picture of the share of services in trade. From a balance of payments generated figure of around 23%, the value-added number for the services share in global trade measured in exports is 45%. So it jumps from 23 to 45, and that 45 is still a significant undervaluation of the relevance of services to in the international economy and to national economies. Indeed, services supplied domestically by logistics providers, for example, like yourselves, may easily find their way into the statistics, into the trade statistics, as goods and not as services. The challenges of measuring trade in value-added terms are daunting, which is why we haven't done this more systematically. But the importance of doing so is quite fundamental in our globalized world, and business and governments should not shy away from this challenge. In the few minutes left to me, let me say a little bit more about services. Of all the advantages I've mentioned that result from measuring trade properly, one of the most important is the insights we get on services. The role of services is badly underestimated in most economic and policy discourse. As already noted, value attributable to services all too often finds its way into the goods statistics. This bends our understanding away from reality. Services are, of course, harder to identify and measure than goods, given their intangibility and the degree to which they are customized. Sources of value emanating from services are not always priced. They're not always even contracted, and they may even take the form of barter. What are these particular sources of value? They can be such things as consistent and considerate treatment of customers, the exchange of knowledge and expertise, effective networking. These are all real sources of value which many, many industries and most governments simply don't have a grasp of. Services that services are not just the glue that joins up supply chains. That's sometimes the view that is taken by less informed people of the logistics and maritime industry, that it's just the glue. It isn't. Logistics offers innovation in very important ways. Innovative solutions can be a source of productivity growth. The role of services as a source of innovation is becoming increasingly recognized, moving away from the old idea that the economies grew their productivity in manufacturing and agriculture, not in services. This is becoming increasingly mythical. It's putting services at the center. At the Fung Global Institute, in partnership with several other agencies and organizations, including the World Trade Organization, we're working to develop a better understanding of the true place of services in national economies and in the global economy. We're convinced that without a refined understanding of where services fit in production, consumption, and trade, business will miss opportunities and governments will formulate less than optimal policies. I believe that these issues are of fundamental interest to the logistics and maritime industry, although I suspect that those industries have a sharper understanding of what I've been talking about than many other industries, particularly non-service industries. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Dr. Patrick Lowe, for the keynote address. Please take a seat. Our next session will be the plenary session, taking the title of Shaping the Future of Asia, the Emerging Dragons, to be chaired by Ms. Barbara Maynard, Director, Fung Global Institute. And just a reminder for the Q&A session, if you would like to pose a question to the panel, please utilize the question papers attached inside the conference booklet. Hand them off to our staff and don't forget to write down your name. Ladies and gentlemen, let's put our hands together for our panel chair and our panel speakers.
Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to be here and to chair this session, which is our first plenary. We've had some very exciting speakers setting the scene, the big picture for you. Let me just say a few words. You know, the topic of this particular session is Shaping the Future of Asia, the Emerging Dragons. And we will be focusing on the AEC 2015. That's the ASEAN Economic Community 2015, which is expected to come into being at the end of 2015. And we will also look at the relationship between AEC 2015, that's the integrated ASEAN, and also China. The executive director of Hong Kong Trade Development Council mentioned that trade, which is now 400 million, is expected to increase to 1 trillion in the year 2020. I would just like to add that with trade comes investment, and it's expected that investment between the two entities, China and the AEC, would be increased by $150 billion in the next 8 years, which means tremendous opportunities for business. I just want to give a graphic picture of what this means. You have China on one side, you have India on the other side, of approximately 1.2, 1.3 billion people. And in the middle, you have an integrated 10 Asian countries with a population of about half of that, which is 600 million. But you see, in ASEAN, what we are talking about is not just integration, but connectivity. There's connectivity throughout. And I think you will hear more from one of the distinguished panel members. But ASEAN and China and is not an isolated community. It has links to the outside world. And again, we will talk a bit about that. And I think it's worth thinking where Hong Kong would fit in all this. The chief executive mentioned many benefits and the importance role that Hong Kong has in the whole scheme of things. And he mentioned something really important, that Hong Kong will start negotiating an FTA with ASEAN in the beginning of next year. And I think the conclusion of that FTA, the free trade agreement, is very important to bring Hong Kong into what else is going on in the rest of Asia. On that note, that's just setting a broad scene. In terms of the arrangements for this seminar, for this session, I will ask each of the panel members to speak for about 8 minutes, and after which we will have a panel discussion. Then I'd like to open the question to the floor. So in the meantime, please send me questions to the TDC staff going around, and they will bring it up here. So the first speaker we have is Mr. Ronald Widdows, who is the chairman of the World Shipping Council and the CEO of Rickmers Holding. He's an expert on shipping with over 40 years of experience, and we're delighted to have him to share with us the benefit of his experience and his insights. Ronald.
Thank you. There's probably some people in the audience that might debate the expert part of that, but thank you very much. My comments today are mostly from the perspective of the World Shipping Council. So very briefly, the World Shipping Council, the WSC, the membership is 29 of the largest container carriers in the world. It handles about, it represents about 90% of the liner industry, about 130 million TEUs of carrying capacity. Liner shipping transports about 60% of the value of global trade, something order magnitude of $4 trillion on an annual basis. So some perspective in terms of global activities comes as a consequence. In terms of just kind of a backdrop for the discussion, the industry has not just entered a cyclical downturn. Some look at it as 5 years. It's really more like 8 years. There's dislocations. There's structural changes that have and are taking place that will fundamentally change this industry. It has implications to trade, to economics, and particularly this area of the world that has an opportunity to leverage off of its location between two very large population areas. So you have volatility, and it may be that we have volatility in terms of rates and fuel prices, demand, supply. This is maybe the way of the world for a long time to come. Not just a down cycle, but really structural changes. Turmoil or dislocations in the financing of an entire industry, which I'll talk about briefly. the entire financial structure of how you finance the assets to support an industry has changed, and in some cases completely gone. The German KG system that built about a third of the container ships in the world, it's gone. That provides some opportunities for other people from a investment standpoint. The emergence of major mega carriers and now mega carrier alliances, it changes the competition landscape in terms of the liner shipping industry. Transformation of the entire world fleet of ships that will take place over the next 10 years or so. As you heard in the opening remarks, and I know others will talk about it a little bit more later, trade flows, mature economies have stalled or reduced significantly. Inter-Asia has continued to grow. And some interesting things begin to shape that haven't even impacted yet. You know, you have a three-decade-long multiples of GDP growth that no longer exists. Whether that comes back again, we'll see. 2009, there was an inflection point where emerging economies and developed economies disconnected from each other. Advanced economies, aging economies, the GDP will be impacted by the aging workforce, aging population, where the emerging economies will go the other direction. Incomes are rising at a more rapid pace today than they ever have in history, and that takes place in emerging economies and certainly within this region. There's nearly 3 billion people will join the consumer ranks of the world, many in this area of the world, and that will affect trade flows in a very different way because of where those people are and how goods will find the way to market. Infrastructure, we'll talk about a little bit later. I won't talk about that right now. But within the Asia range, there's about 30% of the world capacity of liner shipping that is dedicated to the inter-Asia service. About another 20% that moves through. So nearly 50% of the assets that carry goods in this sector move through or around in this part of the world. Huge networks which become more sophisticated. As the area grows, the opportunity to build more sophisticated supply chains. But the investment associated with this today, as well as the renewal, is massive. The world fleet today of all ships is something order of magnitude almost $1 trillion between the existing and new orders. Massive investment required. Now comes environmental standards and fuel economy needs that are going to drive an entire new phase of investment. And where is that going to come from? A third of the container ships, the system is gone. The investors are gone, the banks are out of that business for the time being. Where is it going to come from? Progressively more from within Asia. Within ASEAN, opportunities are massive for investors, for the financing of assets required. One of the reasons for the assets being required, people have kind of forgotten that in 2020, under MARPOL Annex 6, the world moves to 0.5% sulfur. On the liner shipping industry alone, the impact of that is estimated $75 to $100 billion on an annual basis. That is coming, and that is going to drive a change in how people think about the assets they have and the need for new technologies and investment around that part of the sector alone, let alone what happens to the rest of shipping in general. We see beginnings of the development of new financial sources of financing, PE money to a degree, but today it's not clear where the financing is going to come from to undertake the massive investment that's going to be required. That's going to develop over time. Asia is going to play a big role in that. Certainly countries within ASEAN have opportunities to do so. Very briefly, from the standpoint of standards, policy making, the need exists for ASEAN to take a role more broadly within Asia for the creation of consistent standards, whether that's environmentally, whether that has to do with customs regulations, banking regulations, competition law. The need for consistent standards on a global basis is going to allow for the free flow of trade and the enhancements to supply chains on a global basis. And ASEAN, countries within Asia, the countries that they cooperate with, Hong Kong specifically, can play a role in the active participation in the process of making sure that we see those standards develop in a consistent way. Thank you.
Thank you, Rono. That was a masterly delivery of the state of the maritime industry in a few minutes. Rono just spoke on the opportunities for Asia and the ASEAN economic community to benefit from the structure changes taking place in shipping globally. The next panel member is Dr. Chakrit Duongkatra. I hope I get that right. And Dr. Chakrit is an academic. He works with the Chulalongkorn University Business School, but he's also been actively involved in the trade negotiation and has an insider view on ASEAN and AEC 2015. And we look forward to having him share with us his insights and perspectives.
Okay, thank you very much, and good morning, ASEAN friends. Good morning, China. Good morning, Hong Kong and international friends. So my role today is to talk about economic integration, especially in ASEAN, and then see the implication of the ASEAN logistics, which is a great topic for today. Okay, like Barbara already mentioned, ASEAN right now is growing with the 600 population, and now the ASEAN has a policy to establish the ASEAN economic communities in parallel with ASEAN social and cultural and also ASEAN politics communities. But my role today, I want to focus upon the ASEAN economic community. And the ASEAN set out the targets to have the complete integration within 2015, which is a plan that we're going to reach. I'm not quite sure whether we can reach 100% of that. Okay. The objective is to have free flow of goods, free flow of services, free flow of investment, and also the skilled labor. And we have target to have the freer flow of capital. And the measure to integrate the economies look like the same experience that we gain in Europe, except the ASEAN don't share the single currency. We have the tariff elimination, which is now 99.9% of our tariff rate is going down to zero. We aim to eliminate or reduce non-tariff barrier reduction. We have to harmonize the standards. Mutual recognition arrangement, in particular seven occupation, which is, for example, like the engineer, architect, dentist, accounting, and to streamline the custom and trade regulation and facilities, and to establish more facilitate investment and service liberalization. The ASEAN set out 12 priority sector, which has to speed up the process of liberalization, ranging from eco-based products, air travel. I think now we have an open sky policy. We liberalize the third freedom, the fourth freedom, and the fifth freedom, which is now a growing business one. The automotives, now tariff went down to zero, and we have to establish more about human resource. E-ASEAN eliminates the ICT sector, and also establish the thing called single window and e-government. Electronic fishery, healthcare, rubber, textile, tourism, and the last one that we have for today, which is logistics. The ASEAN economic integrations encompass more than 20 agreements involved, ranging from agreements involved in goods, like the AFTA, like the agreements involved in services, like the AFAS, we do the positive list, and we have some investment agreement to keep liberalization and protection. And apart from that, we have more about facilitation involving in the custom, transport, maritime, and also the road transportation. And apart from liberalization, the ASEAN highlight the degree of greater physical connectivity, people connectivity, and regulatory connectivities, ranging from completion of ASEAN highway, and we target to link ASEAN with India and final destination would link the ASEAN India plus until we reach Istanbul, Turkey. This is the ultimate plan. And strategic two, to complete implementation of Singapore Kunming rail links. This is the plan, but we will still have investigate and need more money to involve. Strategic three, establish the efficient and integrated interland waterway network. And we try to flag the thing called single shipping policies, like what in Europe. Okay. Institutional connectivities. We want to fully operationalize the three framework agreement on transport facilitation, good in transit, multimodal transport operation, and also the interstate. And also we link some people connectivities, having more trade association involvement. And within logistics, the ASEAN always sets out the logistic roadmap. The logistic roadmap is trying to complement the integration of the single market within 2015. And the measure, when we mention about the logistic, we want to focus only the freight logistic, nothing about passenger logistic. And we set out the five elements to be involved, starting from liberalization of services sector, trade and logistic facilitation, with ASEAN put more emphasis on the second one. And the third one is to improve the capacity of service provider, human resource, plus multimodal transport. And because logistics sector is ranked among the top 12 priority sector, then the completion date that we plan is not 2015. So we a little bit shorter to 2013, which is this year. And we try to eliminate the foreign equity partnerships, and we want to target 70% owned by the foreign ownership, which is like now a little bit lag behind the target. And these are the market that we open for the foreign equity participation. Some country in ASEAN can do 70%. Some country like now, we can do only 49% because of limitation of regulation. Involving transportation and non-transportation, for example, the maritime, the freight transport agency, packaging, and also the custom clearance. And these are the thing that we put more emphasis is to do some trade facilitation. We take some element from WTO and WCO frameworks to make our regulation crystal clear. We encourage 24 multiplied by 7 custom operation at the select cross-border point. And we aim to develop the single window approach, single window e-logistic, that is we plan, but we still lag behind the target. And we implement risk management practice, and we promote e-commerce technology like the RFID and GPS to keep the ability of tracking along the way. Logistic facilitation. Apart from building the great network, the highways, the port network, and we do some institutional platform, we already have the ASEAN framework agreement on facilitation of interstate transport. But not all the party in ASEAN ratify this agreement. Then we have to conclude and speed up the process of ratification. The same thing happened to the good in transit. I think now we have only 4 countries in ASEAN ratify the good in transit, and the rest must investigate more. And we try to encourage the agreement of multi-transport agreement. And again, only 4 countries ratified to the MTO agreements. So we have to speed up more. And we improve the land transport connectivities, both in the ASEAN plus sub-regional in ASEAN, especially the GMS Greater Mekong sub-region, comprising the 6 countries in ASEAN plus the southern of China. And we enhance participation of transport logistic infrastructures, not only the ports, but involve special economic zone, container yard, ICD, plus the build on and transfer platform. And the other ones, to expand the capacity of logistic service provider, promote regional cooperation of logistic service providers. I think part of the service providers are the member of the party for today. And develop the more database, human resource plus the multimodal transport. Okay, that's it, the food for thought. And I think the future implication of AEC to ASEAN logistics plus Hong Kong, because now we have the globalization of supply chain, and the supply chain that's having more focus in ASEAN, this must be supply chain ranked in 12 priority sectors ranging from automotive, electronics, agro-based, and more opportunity of trade investment in Southeast Asia. Because when we open up the market, we're not open only for the ASEAN. We open to 200 countries in the world. And in particular in Hong Kong, you can make more opportunity of third-party invoicing because this is some kind of rule of the origin operation which allow non-parties to annex the invoice in order to make use of FTA. And ASEAN as a springboard to other markets because we do a lot of FTAs ranging from ASEAN among ourselves. We do connectivity is China, India, Korea, ASEAN plus six. And next step, we're going to explore more relationship with Europe. And right now, the ASEAN is ready for investment and logistics. I think we can keep more discussion in the next round. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chagrit. I think this gives you very well the overall picture of the what is envisaged for the integrated and connected economic community in 2015. Dr. Chagrit made a brief reference to the ASEAN plus six, and I'd like to come back to this when we discuss with the panel, because the ASEAN plus six are also discussing to form a broader economic, comprehensive economic partnership, comprehensive regional economic partnership, RCEP, which is also scheduled to be completed at the end of 2015. And when that is completed, it will comprise about half of the world's population, which makes it the largest free trade and economic zone in the world. And it will have huge implications for logistics and distribution. But we'll leave that to later. Let me now invite George Yeo to be the next speaker. George is the chairman of Carry Logistics and Carry Logistics Network. And he's formerly a senior minister with the Singapore government. And George will speak on the topic of ASEAN and China intertwined future. George, please.
Early this year, China State Councillor Yang Jiechi said, for the first time, China's trade with its neighboring countries overtook China's combined trade with the US and EU. And looking at the trends, China's trade with its neighbors will overtake year by year even more its trade with the US and the EU. The intersection point is at about $1.2 trillion. These are huge trends. A few months ago, China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi said, for 128 countries on Earth, China is the number one trading partner. There are about 190 plus countries in the United Nations. So for 128 countries, China is already the number one trading partner. Now, these are his numbers of historical importance. A few weeks ago, when President Obama was preoccupied with the shutdown of the US government and forced by US domestic politics to remain in Washington, President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Keqiang made very successful visits to the countries of Southeast Asia for APEC and for the ASEAN meetings. For the first time in Indonesian history, a foreign leader was invited to address Parliament. In his speech, President Xi said, China's trade with ASEAN last year crossed $400 billion. 10 years before that, it was slightly over $50 billion. He set a target for 2020, $1 trillion. These are not numbers thrown out lightly. To achieve $1 trillion, a million things must be done in terms of free trade agreements, harmonization, connectivity, border clearance, investment protection, use of the renminbi. A whole range of obstacles will have to be overcome. What it means is, in the coming 8 years, a huge transformation will take place in the relationship between China and Southeast Asia. And China's objective is not just trade or economic development. China's objective is strategic and political. Creating a whole periphery of countries around China which see their interests in China's continuing development, and all within that circle, sharing a common interest in peace, peaceful resolution of conflict, and cooperation. So 2 weeks ago, in Beijing, President Xi Jinping called for a multi-agency meeting. And it was entitled Rang, 共同体意识在周边国家落地生根. Let 让命运共同体意识. Let the consciousness of a common destiny among neighboring countries 在周边国家落地生根, take root. And between China and ASEAN, this has the greatest historical significance. China fully intends to have its destiny and ASEAN's destiny tied together. Will it happen? We don't know. It depends. Firstly, ASEAN itself must stay together, and which is why the AEC, which Dr. Chakrit talked about, is so important. But ASEAN by itself is meaningless. It has to be ASEAN together with China, ASEAN with Japan, ASEAN with India, ASEAN with the US, ASEAN with the rest of the world. But ASEAN with China will be a critical aspect of it. And it is not the first time that the countries of Southeast Asia have seen the rise of China. They have seen it again and again in history, going back to the Tang, the Song, Yuan, Ming, Qing. And each time China was united and prosperous, it brought prosperity to Southeast Asian countries. And this time, a new China trade is flowing. A previous China trade created Hong Kong, made it necessary to the British East India Company. A new China trade, far greater in its volume, will reunite us, West Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, in this century. So the Chinese are pushing for the establishment of an Asian infrastructural fund, in order to build infrastructure, connecting China to Southeast Asia, connecting all of Asia together, so that the rise of China can be a peaceful one, that we will not repeat a Western experience of the rise of one power leading to revolution and war being seen happening in Asia. And President Xi in Jakarta said, not just land connectivity, but also maritime connectivity, meaning Indonesia and the Philippines. Indonesia, of course, is the largest country in Southeast Asia, of great importance to China. But also in the subtext, the Philippines, with whom China has temporary difficulties, which I hope and believe will be resolved in the coming years. So if you take a look at the overall picture, it is almost astonishing in its breathtaking sweep of the changes before us. And as with all things, for these changes to take place, you need logistics. Logistics development in all its dimensions, air, land, sea, rivers, communications, electronic. But most importantly, for things to move, for money to move, for information to move, people must move. And people drawn from different cultures and traditions, from east and west, north and south, must open their minds and hearts to one another and see in the interchange mutual benefit. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, George. Now, we've looked at some of the connectivity issues. What is also to connect us is technology. And we have an expert here in the person of Robert Lee, Executive Director, Supply Chain for Asia Pacific, Lenovo Group. He's going to share with us what Lenovo is doing in ASEAN and in China, and specifically and including what they are doing on the e-commerce B2B basis. Because I think, and I'm sure you all agree, that technology will have a really important role in the next few years for us. So Ronald, please.
Robert. Thanks, Barbara. So today I will share with everybody from different view because I come from the single commercial entity. So I cannot give a very high level and whole world's data and the introduction to everybody like Dr. Patrick. But I will share with you the story of Lenovo, how we grow in this IT industry. Then from our strategy to look at the whole ASEAN, Hong Kong, China relationship, and how we grow in this market, and what's the opportunities we can identify in the future. We as a manufacturing vendor can work with all of the logistic vendor together to grow, and also what's the challenges we are facing. We need the logistic vendor and other finance banking working together to conquer this one and to get another level of achievement. So this year, 2013, is very important for Lenovo. Why? Because by the second quarter of this year, we achieved the number one market share of the PC around this world. In the Q3, the just past quarter, we even improved our market share around this world to be 17.7%. I think this is a very good result of the data. But what I want to share with everybody is not just the data, how beautiful it is, because we are not satisfied with that. We are looking forward to achieve more in the next 3 or 4 years. So how we make it happen? So let's look back. I think very important thing is we have a correct strategy, which is a protect and attack strategy. We followed for the past 4 years come from Chairman Liu and Chairman Yang. So what's the protect and what's the attack? So in the whole PC market, we protect our major base of the China, and which contributes most profit of the whole group, and also Sync brand, which is high brand for us. We attack for our consumer business and attack in our emerging market. So ASEAN and AP is one of the most important attack area for us to grow market share, to grow our revenue and profit here. So in the past 3 years, we find in ASEAN, our shipment increased more than 55%. So that's give a great contribution to the whole corporate growth for the market share perspective. And why ASEAN is so important for us? With all of the data we can know from World Bank and other organizations, we can see ASEAN is a very attractive place, have faster economic growth. And follow the World Bank data, the GDP in ASEAN grows more than 50% from the year 2008 to 2012. And most important thing is, as Barbara just mentioned, ASEAN has a big base of population. It is more than 600 million people just following China, India, around this world. All this big base of people and fast growing of the economy will deliver the huge demand in the PC and the PC Plus product. And also the people have a strong requirement to connecting with the world through this kind of mobile devices. Nowadays we can find from a consumer perspective, more and more people, they utilize the PC, the mobile, the phone, and the tablet more and more. Even you spend more time with those devices than your wife or husband for one day. So people more likely to go through these, utilize these devices to go for search engine and online shopping, and also some virtual social connecting. Just like the big city like Beijing, Shanghai, Manila, and Jakarta, we are facing a very serious traffic issue. Now, we can find more and more people that like online shopping rather than just go to the physical shop to take a look and select and pay money there, because they don't want to spend more time stuck on the road rather than shopping. So online shopping will transform the whole industry of the supply chain and the logistics and give lots of opportunities and challenge to us. And from commercial side, we also can find for ASEAN country, with this economic growth, the local government have a more requirement to develop the education and help people to get more higher education. If I look back, the 25 years ago, the Deng Xiaoping, who was the former Chinese government leader, said one famous sentence, computer education must start from children. So we can find that more and more government in ASEAN countries, they're looking forward to more support from our computer vendors to provide the convenient devices for the education, for the kids, for the children. So that's why we can see there's a huge opportunity in this market, can support Lenovo growth and the whole IT industry's growth in this market. So we are also another thing is we are transforming ourselves, the whole industry from PC to PC Plus, because nowadays we can find the people utilize more about tablet and smartphone. And this also bring the opportunity to our manufacturing vendor and logistic vendor to develop more application and more infrastructure to improve our end-to-end transparency of the supply chain and improve the efficiency of the supply chain. And very important is Lenovo also transform ourselves from PC to PC Plus vendor. Just last quarter, we achieved a record number with our shipment of a tablet and a smartphone. First time, more than PC. So in overall business, we can find a huge opportunity in the next 3 or 5 years for the growing of the PC Plus. By the IDC forecast, we can see there will be more than 91% increment in the next 3 years in the whole PC Plus industry, including PC, tablet, and mobile phone. And Hong Kong, I think, will play a very important role. It's kind of a irreplaceable position in this trend of the PC industry. Why? As of today, we can find more than 85% of our components and finished goods were produced in China and ASEAN countries. So it's still ASEAN and China is a major base for the IT industry, and lots of physical goods moving. Like George mentioned, logistics is very, very important, because without logistics, we cannot move in those goods. And Hong Kong plays a very important role, because Hong Kong is the center of China and ASEAN. and with is a very mature the facility in the cargo airport and the ocean port. So as I know that Hong Kong today is still the biggest cargo airport of the Hong Kong airport. And also the Hong Kong very stable, we find Hong Kong very stable finance policy and have very good tax benefit. So all these things attractive the all the commercial entity to make Hong Kong as a trade center, as a hub to import and export to the ASEAN country. So also we are facing lots of challenges. Today I want to share with you, and maybe tomorrow we can work with some vendors. We can both think about it, how to conquer it and bring the whole industry to be transformed. The first one is the trade regulation. As we all find that some of all of the ASEAN countries growing very fast. And also for the local government, they're more interested in the direct investment rather than importation. So we can find more and more regulation come to us for the product certification, testing, and the trade compliance. So we need logistics. I think logistic vendor can bring more than the service than shipping and keeping the goods in the warehouse. But working as a strategic vendor for working for the how to conquer those trade protection and also work together have a smoothly time to market for move our product to those countries. And also very important, we can utilize the logistic very mature local facilitation to build up our network, join the network to make a more postponement, more manufacturing locally in each country to meet local customer requirement and also to help the manufacturing vendor to grow. The second one is come from the pressure or opportunity of the e-commerce transformation. We can find with the, all of the technical development and also the mobile device more and more popular, we have a more mature network and a requirement to the logistic, to the supply transparency, end-to-end transparency from supplier to the front-end retail. How to make the whole the supply chain to be the same as what President Xi Jinping mentioned, 命运共同体, to really integrate together. I think IT from infrastructure is the one. Another one is how to build the trust, strategic trust across the logistics vendor, supplier, manufacturing vendor, our retail. And even provide this benefit to interlock with our banker to do some more supply finance to help the end-to-end supply chain to contribute more value. And the next one is for B2C. We can find more and more B2C business come to us. What will transform the whole supply chain and the logistics? The B2C requests more, not just people going online to buy something, but also requests more customized things. Even for the smartphone, maybe they request more different color, different image. They even put some the words, the wishes on the cover of the smartphone and give to a friend as a gift of the birthday. So which request our end-to-end supply chain not just make a manufacturing, but also considering customer experience and requirement. How to make a customized manufacturing, customized the shipping, and deliver to customer more on time. And also to provide customer good transparency and good experience, help the manufacturing vendor like Lenovo to grow. So that's the things I think we need to think about it, and with more help from our logistic vendor working together to bring the whole IT industry to be transformed with to another level, to grow in with a double size in next 3 years. So thanks.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Robert. We have now heard the views on the shipping industry. We've heard about AEC 2015. We have heard about China and the relationships between the two. We have now heard, we've just heard the view from an industry. The next speaker will share with us his experience in Europe, because Europe is way ahead of us in terms of experience, in terms of logistics. And so Justin Saturov, who's global head of logistics, will share with us that his experience and information. Justin.
Thank you, Barbara. Good morning, everybody. First of all, I'd just like to say how pleased I am to be here and how much I've been looking forward to this morning's discussion. Just thinking about what's been said already, the comments around the slowdown in growth rates, about the importance of intra-Asian flows. Coming from a European perspective, where if we're lucky, we may have 1 or maybe 2% growth next year, and that would be seen as a huge success. The rates of growth that you're talking about here are so exciting, and the opportunity for logistics is obviously huge. And I think it's also worth remembering that the growth of domestic consumption in Asia is inevitably going to be part of the driver for the economic growth in the rest of the world. I said I'd try and draw some comparisons and parallels between what's happening in Europe in logistics with what's going to happen here. I think it's worth picking up on some of the differences. And growth is obviously one of the important ones. Europe has never been a high-growth region, or at least not during my working life. The complexity that the physical geography of Asia brings compared to Europe or indeed North America, which are, you know, broadly large land masses, is significant and obviously increases cost. I think the complexity and diversity in politics, in regulation, in culture, also impacts on the way supply chains work and the cost that's involved in delivering goods around the region. But I think there are some lessons from Europe. After all, it is a developed marketplace. It is consumer-led. It is substantially urbanized. It does have a developed infrastructure system. And from a logistics perspective, at least, it's efficient. If you think Germany spends about 8% of its GDP on logistics, and you compare to China that spends some 18%, or India that spends 13%, there are some opportunities that aren't just around the difference in the mix of the economies, the service versus manufacturing. We've talked a number of times through this morning about infrastructure, and infrastructure inevitably is a major driver of that additional cost, and the need for additional infrastructure within the region is obvious. China is talking about spending 10% of its GDP on infrastructure, and you can compare that to the USA that spends some 2%. Whether the US needs to be spending more than 2%, I'll leave others to judge. But the need locally to spend significant sums of money on infrastructure is obvious. Outside China, government tends to be small in US terms, and the tax base is relatively thin. So how large infrastructure projects are to be funded is one of the challenges that needs to be dealt with, and I suspect inevitably requires a certain amount of private finance to make that happen. So either the user is going to end up paying for it, or the taxpayer is going to end up paying for it. Given the state is going to be judging these things on their long-term socio-economic benefit, and the private sector is going to be looking about how much profit it can make, the projects that the state may favor are not necessarily the same ones as the private sector is going to want to get involved with. And that may mean that there is an element of subsidy required to get the right infrastructure in place. If you look at the UK, we're still getting benefit from the rail investments that were made 150 years ago. Very hard to get that kind of timescale built into a finance model that you could get through a modern corporate. What the private sector is good at for infrastructure is the design, the build, the maintenance, and the operation. They tend, in Europe at least, to price the demand risk, the volume, quite highly, and that there may therefore be an opportunity for the model that's appropriate to be about government taking demand risk, volume risk, taking the income and paying the private sector a fee to deliver some of these infrastructure projects.
Thank you.
I had a couple of more thoughts, Barbara.
You were pausing.
Within Europe, obviously, because of the way the EU has developed, non-tariff barriers, so custom clearances, cabotage, restricted practices have been dealt with very efficiently. There is a huge opportunity to improve trade by dealing with those. There was a paper presented at the World Economic Forum recently, which was talking about if you could get to 50% of best practice, that that was six times as effective as removing all tariff barriers. One of the similarities in the logistics sector, both in to Europe to here, is how fragmented it is. It isn't a series of pan-European logistics companies. It is a very fragmented sector. If you look at the freight forwarding market in the UK, for example, only 12% of those businesses have turnover of more than £5 million. So really, really quite a long tail. And the importance of local delivery with local skills is absolutely fundamental. You can't treat Europe as a homogenous unit. You have to deliver things locally. And the same inevitably will be true here. And when we talk to customers and look at what they're looking for from their logistics companies, they buy locally, they look for local skills and expertise. And even when they're contracting with the pan logistics networks, the focus is what they can do domestically. And the ability to effectively integrate pan-European operations across political borders actually hasn't been great, and they do tend still to operate on a domestic national basis. One final thought, if I might, Barbara. The logistics in Europe, the innovation has been driven by retail rather than manufacturing, and there's been a series of waves of innovation over the last few years, and the last one inevitably has been driven by e-commerce and e-tailers. The logistics industry has struggled to make money from that business. If you look at the price they're able to charge for home delivery, the price they're able to charge for e-fulfillment, they tend to be unprofitable, albeit huge growth opportunities, hence the reason why they're so popular. And the changes in the way e-commerce has worked and the changes in the different routes to market have been really quite significant. If it started with home delivery, it's become much more complicated than that, and it's about deliver to work, drop boxes, parcel shops, etc. They have to deal with the peaks, and there's, I understand, going to be a fairly significant peak here driven by sales on the 11th of November. And how you design a network to deal with peak flows that may be four times as big as the base load is obviously a real issue. And finally, a thought on reverse logistics. Fundamental to e-commerce is an ability to return goods. We have examples in Europe where women's fashion retailers anticipate a 50% returns rate or more as customers order two or three different sizes, try one, keep one, and return. Try them all, keep one, and return the rest. And even more extreme examples in electronics retailers, where they have free return above a certain value. So customers they order three or four televisions online. They get them home, they unpack them, they choose one, having tried it out in their room, and then they have free return of the others. And the complexity involved in collecting those televisions, repackaging the televisions to put them back into the supply chain, obviously adds both cost and complexity to the way the supply chain works. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin. Okay. We've heard the views, very interesting views, from our five distinguished panel speakers. I just like to pick up the point on infrastructure, because we talk about integration, connectivity, logistics, and it's going to work only if there is adequate infrastructure. Let me deal with the infrastructure. At the recent ASEAN-China summit in Brunei, China proposed to an ASEAN Infrastructure Investment Bank, and I'm quoting, to give priority support to ASEAN connectivity projects. The amount involved is substantial. I think in Thailand alone, the government had already approved an investment of $70 billion over the next 8 years. So what I would like to do is to ask the panel members, where will the funds come from for these huge investments that need to be made, and will it happen? Let me start in the same order as the speaker. So Ronald, please.
Well, the good news for Asia is so much of the infrastructure development that's taken place, countries like China that have invested massive amounts of funds in infrastructure continue to. They do that strategically in a very smart way, now begin to impact how other countries in the area do, building linkages on the land side, which they'll participate in. other countries that have done a very good job in developing infrastructure. Port terminal infrastructure has come a long ways over the last, say, two decades. On the land side, not quite so. So much of the investment, much of the impact relative to how it affects supply chain, how that affects sourcing, manufacturing as we go, will have to do with land side development, linkages to China, linkages between countries, as well as the continuing development of port and terminal activity or infrastructure to support gradually bigger, more sophisticated networks on the ocean. And this region of the world, unlike where I'm from, the U.S., that has no money, has a greater need but can't get over it, understands the importance and the impact that it has on economic growth for the region. So generally good news.
Thank you. Shakur?
Thank you very much. The question about infrastructure development, I think we have to analyze into two infrastructure. The first one is about transport infrastructure encompassing ports, airports, rail, and also land transport, motorway connection, thing like that. And the other infrastructure is about trade infrastructure. For example, building industrial estates, special economic zone, or upgrading some cross-border checkpoint, something like that, because we have to aggregate these two. And regarding to China proposal to grant as an assistant to build, I think we have to look into the detail, because some of the contracts, we need to employ China participation 50% or 100% and use some general condition. From the Thailand perspective, I think we try to use domestic money first, okay? Unless otherwise we look into the external sourcing like that. In regarding to Thailand and some least developed countries in ASEAN, for example, like Cambodia, Myanmar, and Vietnam, I think special effort would go to the land transport and rail transport connectivities. And I think our discussion already lie on the, we call the corridor, just like the land bridge in US, in USA, and we in our context, we call corridor. We set out at least three corridor, North-South Economic Corridor, linking Kunming and Bangkok, we call Kunmankonglu. We call Kunmankonglu. And the second one, which is where it's rabbit, is try to link the Eastern and the Western Economic Corridor, starting from the middle part of Vietnam, and let's to the middle part of Laos, and then pass to the western and the eastern side of Thailand, and then get to Myanmar. This one, we can see some development in infrastructure. And also the Southern Economic Corridor, and this one is a particular thing. But infrastructure always there, but how to make use of the corridor is still some questionable, because we have a number of regulations to be imposed, some quota limitation of the trucking, interstate and good in transit, in which we have more than 100 goods which are not prohibited to travel along this route. And about the port infrastructure, the ASEAN has set out priority investment into 47 designated ports, in which is international ports. In Thailand, I think we have three ports within 47. I think that's one to keep upgrades. And the airport, I think, is go for international and especially congest one. Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you. George?
The engineering is not a problem in terms of creating connectivity. The problem will be long-term financing risk. And I believe China's approach will be a practical, creative one, depending on the particular situation in each country. To drive a fast rail from Kunming to Bangkok, you got to go through either Laos or Myanmar. Laos has a small population, and Laos by itself doesn't need a high-speed rail. So they've got to be creative. What can China offer Laos? Maybe land, maybe electricity. We don't know. But China will be creative. For Thailand, I met a Chinese businessman recently. He said, well, maybe we can do a counter trade for rice. Long-term rice supply to China, which will solve some of the problem of the huge surplus, and China putting more money into real development. With Malaysia, maybe palm oil, maybe gas, whatever. And China is thinking very big, even the possibility of a bridge to Sumatra. We can be sure a lot of that trade, of the infrastructural development, will be denominated in renminbi. The other point I want to make is Myanmar's opening up, which is the last piece of the jigsaw slotted into place. Because Myanmar enables China now to bypass the South China Sea or create an alternative route to the Indian Ocean. Therefore, it is of enormous strategic importance. On the Indian side, they view China's growing connectivity with Southeast Asia with interest and with a certain measure of concern. So Indonesia also wants connectivity with ASEAN through Myanmar. The result is ASEAN will, in the end, link India and China together by land. And this will open up another universe of possibilities.
Thank you. Robert?
Okay. So my first point, the same as Mr. George, I think railway infrastructure is very important for the between the China and the ASEAN, because currently we can see very mature infrastructure by air, by ocean between China, Hong Kong, and the ASEAN country. But the issue is by air you are fast but very expensive. By ocean you are very cheap but very long lead time. So the railway I think is very important for the whole China and ASEAN countries' economic growth, because here we have a huge population. The railway is a very good solution to help all of the country link together to develop the business and develop economy. And the second one is, I think for the investment to the ASEAN country in terms of the infrastructure, not just only build up infrastructure, but also really look at which kind of business can bring to those areas we build up the infrastructure. And what's the more value-added service between the cross this goes through this infrastructure to link with China, Hong Kong, and other ASEAN countries to really bring more economic benefit to this country rather than just one-time investment. So that's my point, Barbara.
Thank you, Justin.
Thanks, Barbara. It seems to me that as George says, the challenge is around funding. I'm not sure that Europe's got the answer to that question, because you only have to pick up a newspaper at home to see the challenges that politicians have to justify that they have actually got benefit for some of the private finance initiatives that have happened. But given a thin tax base, given the size of these projects, some sort of private finance I think is inevitable. And the challenge is making sure that the projects that are brought forward have been thought through, and the commercial rationale for them is presented in a way that allows the private sector to see the profit that it's going to make from being involved. As a final thought, if you look at Europe and you look at the infrastructure that's been spent on roads, railways, airports, ports, without subsidy, I'm not sure how effective the rail freight sector would be, and whether that's the flexibility the flexibility that road has to move goods to where the demand is and where the supplies are and respond to short-term changes compared to rail, whether that continues to be an issue for Asia or not, I don't know.
Thank you. We have about 20 minutes left, and I have many questions from the floor. So let me start with two general questions to all the panel members. I'll ask them at the same time, and you can address them, any one of them, in any order. The first is, what does Hong Kong need to do to improve and maintain its position as the hub for China and other ASEAN countries? So that's the first question. from the perspective of Hong Kong. The second is, what is your view on the China global trade performance, particularly with the US, given the China industrial upgrade reform and the AEC in 2015 and the TPP, which is scheduled to come out in 2014. So let me start the other way. Justin, you go first this time.
Thanks, Barbara. I wonder if the opportunity in for Hong Kong is to look at some of the e-fulfillment solutions that are being developed for e-commerce. I'm thinking of some of the recent press that's been put out by Singapore Post, for example, and the opportunity to act as the e-fulfillment hub for some of the retailers coming out of Europe into the region, looking for a way to maximize on the opportunity created by e-commerce. Because I'm conscious that Alibaba is already bigger in turnover terms than Amazon and eBay combined. So the opportunity for European retailers coming into the region is obviously huge.
Thank you. Robert?
Okay, my view to the first question is, I think Hong Kong today have a very good infrastructure for a logistic network and also have a very mature financial institution. So what the next step is how to integrate them together to well to provide a total solution to the manufacturing vendor and integrate both logistics and financing together. Because also today, we can find, like take an example, PC industry, 80% of the cost come from the components, the physical goods, physical component. And we move the physical goods from plant through Hong Kong to the destiny port. Still this way, maybe if you take out by 10 days from you get order to the give to customer. By ocean, you need 20 or 25 days. Whether we can utilize more finance banking system or solution to give more service to this vendor, no matter it's a customer or manufacturing vendor, to provide more financial benefit, then we can, I think we can gather all of the strengths of Hong Kong port from logistic and finance perspective, and again the benefit. I think this is one for the is for next another value-added service to those manufacturing vendors.
Thank you, George.
Hong Kong's links with the mainland are profound, and those links will become stronger with every upgrade of the Hong Kong-China economic partnership arrangement. Hong Kong's links with Southeast Asia are weak, and the knowledge of individual Southeast Asian countries has got to be built up over a period of time. And it's got to be done at different levels. At a governmental level, Hong Kong should really seek to establish proper offices in every of the 10 ASEAN countries and at the ASEAN headquarters in Jakarta. And these offices should not just be promoting trade, they should be promoting investments, culture, as part of what we hope will be an early conclusion of the Hong Kong-ASEAN Free Trade Agreement. In other words, the Free Trade Agreement is not an end in itself. It should only set the stage for profound integration of ASEAN with Southeast Asian countries. You need to do many other things at different levels. You need the universities to have Southeast Asian departments. You need think tanks. You need conferences, seminars, so that the degree of comfort between someone from Myanmar, someone from Hong Kong, between someone from Cambodia and someone from Hong Kong is brought to a different level. And only then can trade flow, can trust be established, can infrastructural connectivity have meaning. And this is a multi-year, long-range effort. But in the end, it will bring huge benefits to Hong Kong, to China, and to ASEAN.
Thank you. Yes.
Yep. Looking from the outsider, I think the question related to Hong Kong Maritime Hub, because in the Far East Asia, we have a high competition of the ports. And I think the quality of Hong Kong is there. I don't think to make a mistake because you already get. But the problem is that because we have to compete with the port in this area, I think if Hong Kong government or Hong Kong ports can lower some transshipment costs, handling costs, and some documentation fee, I think it's a good one. Because now the cost that I mentioned, the third-party invoicing is already there. the goods from ASEAN to China can pass to Hong Kong. If you lower the cost of administration in annexing the invoice, it could be benefits because Hong Kong, the quality is there. And the other solution is that because one of the grading of Hong Kong is human resource, perhaps you export your service, internationalization, through ESRA with the port or logistic activity in Southeast Asia, and then you can build some strong connection to Hong Kong. And the question related to China, I think China is doing very well, except only the middle part and the western part of China. I think we have more room to grow. Otherwise, it's concentrated, particularly on the southern part and the eastern part. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think Hong Kong and Singapore have been, I think the governments have probably been the most proactive in thinking about how they develop their maritime sector, the broad suite of services that attract businesses and facilitate trade. Hong Kong has done a good job. I mean, the banking system, the financial systems, trade finance, the ease of doing business, which has attracted business here, even though, as was mentioned, the cost might be a bit higher than they are in, say, some of the South China ports. I think the continuation of the development of the suite of activities that attracts business, a focus on the regulatory issues that I mentioned in my opening remarks, are important, not just for Hong Kong, but for the region in general. In that respect, Hong Kong and Singapore are not competing with each other. They're part of a more holistic system that requires standards that will facilitate trade broadly across the region that they'll both benefit from. The second question about China and the U.S., I think the dynamics have shifted considerably as a function of China beginning to consume more. So China sourcing from within the Asia range to a much greater degree, not just agricultural products, commodities, but manufactured goods, components. That changes the trade flows somewhat behind the changes in the diminished flows in the mature markets. That probably continues for a period of time. But the development of that consuming capability within China, more broadly the rest of Asia, that will change flows as you look forward over, say, the next decade relative to the U.S.
Thank you. One more question from the floor, a general question. What is the speaker's view on the opportunities and challenges from human resource perspective in light of the employer's investment in ASEAN? I'd like to rephrase that question to where do you see the skills development in ASEAN and ASEAN and China? And is there a skill gap right now that could derail the things that we are talking about? Again, Justin, please.
Thanks, Barbara. I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. Certainly, if you look at the European experience, quality management is the biggest scarce resource in the logistics space, and the need to train and develop and attract quality management into the sector is an ongoing challenge. And I assume the same will be true here. The need to pay attractive rates to employees to ensure that you don't get a churn of staff, to ensure that you get efficiencies, is certainly one of the lessons of the European marketplace. And there's a trend in the UK around something called the living wage, actually looking to pay people more than a basic standard of living. And certainly the lessons seen from that seem to be that it has economic benefit in the longer term.
Thank you. Robert?
I'm not sure whether I can answer your question or not. So by my observation, firstly, that for between the China and ASEAN, from the Thailand perspective, there's lots of quite difference. Because let's look at the China people growing in a very system and the education with very good with paper testing, with mathematics, with logic. But for the people in ASEAN, with the strength of the language, they're good in the presentation, in talking, communication. So I think that how we treat the difference between the China, Thailand, and ASEAN, Thailand should be a different way, and maybe the make them to enhance each other and merge with each other's strengths and to make more sharing and communication with each other. And then another thing is that in like Lenovo, the global economic entity, we motivate the people have more communication and stay together to share with each other, not only just from a skill perspective, but also very important to understand each other. Even you're talking about all in English, but maybe you're talking in a different way. Understand each other on the same page, understanding of a culture, and then we go another level about how to support each other from skill, from experience perspective.
Thank you, George.
I completely share Robert's view that cultural understanding is a key. ASEAN is a very diverse region. We are 50% Muslim. Many are Buddhists, both from the Mahayana and the Hinayana traditions. There are many Christians, especially in the Philippines and Indonesia. Then there are Hindus, there are Taoists, there are others. When we don't know someone well, it's easy to be trapped by stereotypes. Oh, he's from this ethnic group, he cannot be trusted. Human society cannot be built up without trust. But the basis of trust is different in different societies. And one has got to go deep to understand, that's how they interact with one another. That's how they express agreement or disagreement, joy or unhappiness. And the more we achieve that cultural understanding, the more we're able to reduce both short-term and long-term risks, and therefore access capital, evaluate contracts differently. And I would say building up cultural understanding is the most difficult because it takes time. You've got to pay to learn very often, but it has got to be done if what we are talking about blithely can be realistically achieved.
Thank you. Yes, please.
I think this question is really difficult one because 11 countries, as in 10, plus China is 11 countries. We share different language, different culture, different skill. But in generic term, I think I can analyze into four strategies. The first strategy is we call the country with low cost and low skill. Low cost and low skill, I think we still have some countries are positioning itself like that. It's like a least developed country, I don't need to name. And the second one is low cost, high skill. Low cost, high skill. I think this country is gaining more popularity to make some factory to relocate. In particular, some sector like a textile will demand more labor intensive. And the third strategy called high cost, high strategies. I think we have some country like this, in particular Singapore, or in Malaysia, we have something like that. In Thailand, we still have something like a high cost, high skill, something like a gems and jewelry, something like a hospitality business. I think we have some strong interest. And the country, which is the last one, is called high cost, low skill. This country might face some difficulty to deal with. Thank you very much.
Rona.
Maybe I come at this a little differently from the standpoint of competitiveness and how countries within Asia in general need to think. Real life example, in my prior life, we built a service center in Shanghai. It was populated with about 600 people, consolidated documentation, some accounting functions there, dramatic reduction in cost, big improvement in productivity. Not long ago, that was moved to Chongqing. We recruited people in Chongqing, almost 1,000 people. Almost all of those people are university graduates, average age 24 years old. Many with foreign language skills beyond just English. There's a drive, there's an intensity, there is a strategy and an organized thinking by government to leverage the education system and a hunger to bring new business, new activities, and that makes it very difficult for countries that don't see the importance or have not yet developed the systems, the education, but mostly the government mindset that this is strategically important, and China's down that road, and the results are dramatic. In Chongqing, 60% the cost of Shanghai. Productivity levels off the scale. People that at individual level have a hunger and a drive and a desire to do and to work. And that same thing has to develop in other parts of the world, or those jobs will not be there. You'll end up with a competitive disadvantage that will be structural, and that's what some other countries need to kind of think about.
Thank you. I have a lot of questions. Many of them are directed to Ronald about the shipping industry, which we won't have time to deal with. And many of them are addressed to George about China. I hope that those of you who have asked the questions would look for the speakers and then discuss with them later. I would just like to conclude with some comments which I received from the Indonesia Logistics Association. The first comment is that we've all been focusing on consumption, but it's the production that creates economic growth, because people need to have the production side who have the money to buy. We won't have time to debate that, but I would say I personally agree with this comment. The second comment is that, again, we have been focusing a great deal on land infrastructure development, but for Indonesia, sea infrastructure is cheaper and better. And again, I think we all agree with that. So on that note of great agreement and on inclusiveness, because we have tended to focus too much on the continental side of Asia, I would like to bring this session to a close. And I'd like you please to, first of all, give yourself a big hand of applause for being such a great audience, please. And then I would like, please, even bigger applause to the panel members. And I hope you enjoy what they have said. Thank you.